matters that had to be taken care of immediately. We now get to the third case today, 10AP208, Aurora Consolidated Healthcare versus Labor and Industry Review Commission, and I have as the lineup 25 minutes for Daniel Zitzer, representing Aurora Consolidated Healthcare and Century Insurance, 15 minutes by Assistant Attorney General Dwayne Harlow, and 15 minutes by Attorney Robert Ward. Mr. Harlow represents Lurk. Mr. Ward represents Jeffrey Schaefer. And 5 minutes rebuttal for Mr. Zitzer. You may proceed, Mr. Zitzer.
May it please the court, Daniel Zitzer of Achen Van Aert, and we're appearing for the plaintiffs, appellants, petitioners, Aurora Consolidated Healthcare, and Century Insurance. I'd like to begin with two thoughts. First, in a 2002 commission case, the commission stated that in every case which it reviews, the commission's ultimate goal is to discern the truth of what actually occurred and to correctly apply the applicable law. That's the Johnson versus Ansell case. The second thought I'd like to express before I get going is that this year, 2011, marks the centennial of the Workers' Compensation Act. This year, we're celebrating the balance that had been reached 100 years ago, balance between competing interests. And if our workers' compensation system is going to continue to achieve that balance, a fair hearing that provides a fair exploration of the evidence for all parties must be a central component. This is a very significant workers' compensation case in terms of the interests of the parties. Mr. Schaefer is alleging that he is permanently and totally disabled as a result of a work injury. This presents a substantial exposure for the employer and the insurance carrier. The principal issues in dispute in the underlying workers' compensation case involve the definition of Mr. Schaefer's functional capabilities following the injury and whether or not there is a viable labor market for him to return to employment. Mr. Schaefer was found to be permanently and totally disabled from the work injury following a hearing before the Workers' Compensation Division. The case was appealed to the Labor and Industry Review Commission, and on appeal, the commission appointed a tiebreaker medical examination to render opinions regarding Mr. Schaefer's functional restrictions pertaining to his back injury. The doctor appointed to perform that examination was Dr. Jerome Ebert. He performed an examination of Mr. Schaefer and outlined a set of functional restrictions attributable to the back injury.
Counsel, just as a point of clarification, was Dr. Ebert's report on a WC-16B?
It was not, Your Honor.
Does that have any implication to whether or not the statute that talks about if you're the physician and that lists a lot of other practitioners, if
right.
you will, consents to cross-examination, isn't that as part of the WC-16B?
It's our position that it's not, Your Honor.
I haven't seen one of those forms, and I couldn't see one, or I didn't see one in the appendix. That's right. I had doctor's reports, but I didn't see WC-16B. Does that WC-16B on its face state anything about, by signing here, I do hereby agree that I will be subject to cross-examination?
It does. It does, Your Honor. It does.
The other doctor and the other reports, I assume, from the doctors that were submitted on WC-16B forms?
Well, there are essentially two ways that
if you don't know, that's okay.
Okay, Your Honor. I don't mean to ask.
I
may have overstated the issue about whether or not it consents to cross-examination.
Okay.
It does contain a place for the doctor to sign certifying the report.
But not, I just haven't seen one for a while. So it doesn't say anything about by signing this report, I do hereby agree to be cross-examined.
It does not state that. It indicates that the doctor is it says that the certification says, I certify subject to the penalty of fine and or imprisonment as provided in section 943.39 of the Wisconsin statutes that the above report truly and correctly sets forth the history, my findings, diagnosis, and opinion. There's also a note at the bottom that references the statute. I think you're thinking of 102.17 sub 1 sub D. It says section 102.17 sub 1 sub D of the Wisconsin statutes provides that contents of certified medical and surgical reports presented by the parties shall constitute prima facie evidence as to the matter contained therein. Reports must be filed with the department and other parties 15 days before the date of hearing to be acceptable as evidence. If so filed, it will be necessary to produce the doctor to give oral testimony at the time of the hearing.
That's part of the WC-16B? Part of the WC-16B form? That's what I'm trying to get.
That it is. I misread it, Your Honor. I'm sorry. It says, if not so filed, it will be necessary to produce the doctor to give oral testimony at the time of the hearing. There are essentially three ways to put a medical opinion in evidence at a workers' compensation hearing. One is by having that opinion attached to a WC-16B form. One is if it's contained in certified medical records filed by the parties before the hearing. And the third is to have the doctor present at the hearing to testify.
So if you do it under one or two, is there cross-examination?
There would not be, because the doctor would not be present at the hearing.
Right. So you can have a situation where it's the party's expert, but there's no cross-examination permitted because the doctor won't be there.
Well, in that case, Your Honor, a party would have the right to subpoena the doctor to come to the hearing. So there would be that right. The doctor's live testimony is not necessary. If the doctor is not there in person, there's no opportunity to cross-examine. But I wouldn't say that cross-examination is prohibited, because the attorneys have the right to subpoena the doctor to the hearing and can cross-examine them.
Yeah, well, that raises another issue. We had cases where you can opposing parties subpoena expert to get testimony.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it does. And there are a couple of relevant statutory provisions. One is Section 102.17 sub C, which provides that either party shall have the right to be present at any hearing in person or by attorney or any other agent, and to present such testimony as may be pertinent to the controversy before the department.
Mm-hmm.
This same language was cited in the Theodore Fleissner case that's cited in some of the briefs. At that time, it was enumerated differently. At that time, it was part of Section 102.17, paren 1, small m, close paren. And in the Theodore Fleissner case, the court was commenting on what is due process in a workers' compensation case, and this statute was cited. It says that the party has the right to present such testimony as may be pertinent, and this right is not limited, Your Honor. The other statute is Section 102.17, paren 2, small s, close paren. That provides that the parties have the authority to subpoena any witness to a hearing. Consequently, in this case, where we have Section 102.17 sub 1 sub G, which provides that any party shall have the opportunity to rebut such report on further hearing, it's our position that any party would have the right to subpoena any witness to that hearing who is in a position to provide relevant testimony. And there are no limitations in Section 102.17, sub 2, sub S, about who can be subpoenaed. And the same is true with the statute we previously discussed. In that situation, the right to elicit testimony would be limited to matters relevant to the proceeding before the department. But that would be the extent of any limitation.
Counselor, in this case, was Dr. Ebert present at any hearing?
He was not, because the hearing was conducted before Dr. Ebert performed his examination and before he provided his two reports.
Okay, so once he provided his report, there was no further hearing?
That's correct.
And then the department made, or the commission made its determination based on a paper record?
Yes, it did.
Okay, and was there ever a request for a hearing where Dr. Ebert would be present?
Yes, there was, Your Honor.
And how was that made?
I made that request in a letter to the commission on May 1, 2009. The commission never responded to that request. Instead, they just rendered their decision on May 28, 2009. And in that decision, they denied my request for a hearing or some other opportunity to cross-examine or question Dr. Ebert. I don't think the Court of Appeals appreciated that in its decision. The Court of Appeals said that after the commission had denied our request to cross-examine Dr. Ebert, we failed to object to the admissibility of his report, but there was no opportunity to do that because I made the request to cross-examine Dr. Ebert. The next thing that occurred was the case was decided, and in that decision, the request was denied.
The Court of Appeals in paragraph 34 says, in short, Rohrer was given ample opportunity to present competent evidence. It goes on, when I was reading this, to, if I recall, take Rohrer to task for, my words, not theirs, sitting on its hands in not asking for cross-examination until May 1st. How do you respond to that sitting on your hands?
Well, I dispute.
You said you weren't sitting on your hands. I'm just pointing out the Court of Appeals is saying you're sitting on your hands, so tell me why they're wrong.
I understand, Your Honor, and I appreciate that very much. The request to question or cross-examine Dr. Ebert could not have been made until the second report of Dr. Ebert was issued. There was substantial time that occurred over the course of handling the case, and I would ask you to keep in mind that when Dr. Ebert provided his first report, he was asked to list the restrictions that were applicable to Mr. Schaefer's back condition. He did that. And after he did that, we submitted a report from our vocational expert. And our vocational expert was of the opinion that there was a loss of earning capacity of less than perm total, 30% is what the opinion was. I would also point out another item in the record. Attorney Ward sent a letter to the department on March 20, 2009. This is record item in our appendix. It's page number 127. And in that letter, Mr. Ward says that, as we discussed, Dr. Ebert's restrictions will need to be evaluated by the vocational experts to determine the impact of these restrictions on Mr. Schaefer's earning capacity. So that's what Mr. Ward was saying on March 20, 2009. I appreciate what the Court of Appeals decision says. Arguments have been advanced by the Commission in this case that our request was tardy. They argue that it was made on the last day for the submission of reports. I would also point out that after the case was first remanded for Dr. Ebert's first report, the department set 90 days as a deadline to submit additional reports. We submitted a report, and Mr. Schaefer did not submit a vocational report at that time. But on February 13, 2009, Mr. Schaefer's counsel, Mr. Ward, sent a letter to the department, and he asked that additional questions be presented to Dr. Ebert. That request was granted. Now, that request was made 4 days after the deadline for submitting reports, 4 days after the 90-day deadline.
Counsel, does it interrupt your flow too much if I ask you to get to the statute?
No.
But if you feel compelled to continue on with this, do so. I mean, if you're...
No, Your Honor, that's fine. The only point that I would like to make there is that by advancing this argument that we were tardy in terms of our request, what the Commission is saying is that the employer and the insurance carrier were essentially subject to a different set of rules than the applicant. And I think that's an element of the loss of fair play in this case. In terms of the statute...
Do they have the discretion to do that, though? Is it like a trial court judge who can decide, you know what, I'm going to allow this, I'm not going to allow that, or is it not discretionary?
Well, it's our position that there's no discretion with respect to the right to question or cross-examine.
Okay. That gets you to the statute, then, I think. Okay, show me in the statute. Show me in the plain or unplain words of the statute, wherever you want to point, to where... The LIRC is required to allow cross-examination of this, I'm going to use the term independent medical exam and mean by that the appointed examiner by LIRC, okay? So where in the statutes is there cross-examination of the practitioner appointed by LIRC? Or is it required?
It is in section 102.17 sub G. And it's the very last part of the statute, which reads that the report shall be furnished to each party who shall have an opportunity to rebut such report on further hearing.
Your argument then centers on whether the word rebut includes the right to cross-examination. That's what your argument is. It isn't a plain... there is nothing that says that the independent medical examiner shall be subject to cross-examination. Your argument is all on this word rebut in sub G, asserting that that means... expressly, that there shall be cross-examination upon request.
I would take the position, Your Honor, that my argument does not focus on the word rebut as much as it does on the words on further hearing. And consistent with the statutes, the other statutes, 102.17, sub 2S, a party would have the right to subpoena any witness to the hearing. And it's my position that by mandating the opportunity for a further hearing, that the legislature is allowing mandating an opportunity to cross-examine the witness if it is requested.
Counselor, I look at DWD 0.22 subsection 2, and DWD 8022 is entitled Use of Physician's Reports as Evidence. And subsection 2 says, use of reports shall be permitted in any case in which claim for compensation is made, provided the reporting doctor is available for cross-examination. Does that section have any bearing at all on what you're talking about or any of the statutes that you brought to our attention?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Could you give me the statute again? 80.22?
It's DWD, so it's administrative rule. DWD 80.22 sub 2. And the title of the section is Use of Physicians' Reports as Evidence. And sub 2 is what I just read to you about reports.
That is getting back to section 102.17 sub 1 sub D, Your Honor, and it's our position that that statute allows reports to be submitted and that the statute requires the physician who's completing the report to be subject to cross-examination. So I believe my answer to your question would be yes.
Okay. Thank you.
I think the Court of Appeals in its decision...
Before you get to the Court of Appeals decision, let's say on sub D, because you said 80.22 relies on sub D. Sub D talks about the report presented by a party. What do you do with that language then? Since this isn't a report presented by a party?
Well, there are several discrete sentences, four discrete sentences in the main part of section 102.17 sub D 1. The first addresses certified reports completed by, we'll just say doctors for the sake of simplicity, who are licensed and practicing in this state. And that section does include the language presented by a party for compensation.
Counsel,
just let him finish.
I'm sorry,
okay?
If you weren't done.
No,
sorry.
He's just getting started.
The second sentence talks about certified reports of doctors wherever licensed and practicing. And it's the second sentence that contains the language, if the practitioner or expert consents to being subject to cross-examination. I believe it's my position that that provision applies in the second sentence because that second sentence embraces doctors wherever licensed and practicing, including out-of-state doctors.
How... are you familiarized with the Neal's book on workers' compensation?
Somewhat.
Now, he or they, however you want to look at it, interpret what you just said is, to save the parties the expense of producing medical practitioners in person to testify, 102.17.1D and WIS Ad Code 80.22 DWD provide that medical and vocational reports may be introduced on certified forms in lieu of testimony. That is the WC-16B. So you would disagree with that interpretation, that it's to save the parties the expense of producing medical practitioners in person to satisfy.
Well, this is an IME that we're talking, independent medical exam. Isn't that what we're talking about with Dr. Ebert?
It's what I would call a tiebreaker examination. I would distinguish a tiebreaker examination from an IME.
Oh, okay.
I would use the term IME to designate a medical opinion obtained by a party.
That's why I prefaced my comment.
Okay,
because
so
usually
this,
IME is a defense. Is a defense.
But getting back to your point, Your Honor.
So he seems to take a different interpretation. He seems to take the interpretation that subsection D is to save the parties the expense of producing medical practitioners in person.
I think it is for that purpose. I think it undoubtedly saves expense and time and difficulty of bringing medical practitioners into a hearing to provide live testimony. But if that's done, Your Honor, the right to cross-examination still exists. If Mr. Ward were to bring a doctor to a doctor's report to a hearing without the doctor being there, I could subpoena that doctor to come to the hearing, cross-examine that doctor.
Who was it that asked Dr. Ebert to do the examination?
The commission asked Dr. Ebert to do the
examination. Okay, so it wasn't a report of a party?
No.
Okay. That I perhaps used the wrong term before, but that was my understanding. Thank you.
So what's the difference between a tiebreaker and this expert? Or is this, why do you call him a tiebreaker? And where is that terminology used in the statutes or in the administrative code or elsewhere?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't think it's used in the administrative code or the statute. I would just colloquially call it a tiebreaker.
Okay. What do we call it under the statutes?
It would be an independent.
A directed?
Independent examiner appointed by the department to perform an examination.
Okay. So where does that person fit in D?
Is it the expert that's referred to online in D1?
If it is a practitioner that is licensed and practicing in this state.
Has he have examined or treated the claimant?
He would have examined the
claimant.
And
then it says, specially says experts. What does that mean? I mean, does he fit into one or the other or both?
I would say he falls into both. I think the term expert also includes vocational experts.
Okay, and then we go back. Did he consent to being subjected to cross-examination?
Did he consent?
Yeah, that's what the next phrase says.
I believe by performing the examination and preparing a report that is presented in evidence in a workers' compensation case, I think he's automatically subject to cross-examination.
Okay.
It's not like a doctor who's out of state who would be outside of the subpoena power of the parties. A doctor who's providing a report and out of state can't be subpoenaed to the hearing because there would be no subpoena power over that doctor. But a doctor who is in state performing an examination at the request of the department or the commission would be subject to subpoena to come to the hearing to testify.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Dwayne Harlow, Assistant Attorney General representing Lurk.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abrahamson. May it please the Court, my name is Dwayne Harlow. I am an Assistant Attorney General with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I represent the Labor and Industry Review Commission in this matter. Throughout this litigation, the single issue that has been presented is whether or not a party has an absolute right to cross-examine an impartial physician who was appointed by the commission under 102.17.1G. The issue has not been whether or not he was afforded a hearing. The issue has not been whether or not he was afforded an opportunity to submit additional medical evidence, because he's asserted all along that that would not have been sufficient. What is required, according to Aurora, is that it be permitted to cross-examine this impartial medical expert that was appointed by the commission.
Why not let him be cross-examined?
Pardon me?
Why not let him be cross-examined? Why the resistance?
Well, Your Honor, the resistance, I think, is because we're trying to not burden these impartial physicians. These are physicians who don't hold themselves out to do adverse medical examinations or what Your Honor might be familiar with as independent medical examinations. The statute specifically says that they can't be under contract for hire, that they can't be individuals who are regularly employed by insurance.
But they're giving evidence in a hearing, and it seems if someone wants to question their opinion, especially a guy that's given two different opinions, first an opinion that said that he could work up to 8 hours a day, and now a later opinion where he can't work at all, I guess I don't understand why the resistance by the commission. I mean, why not see what people want to ask them?
Well, again, Your Honor, number one,
he's getting paid. He's not doing this free, right?
Right, but again, this is a physician who doesn't hold himself out to hire for these sorts of things. Well, Your Honor, the so what is that this isn't an individual who says my time is worth X and I'm willing to take money from these insurers to do these sorts of things and appear at hearings. This is an individual who is a busy person who doesn't necessarily, perhaps, want to devote an entire day to appear at a workers' compensation proceeding to be cross-examined by Mr. Zitzer or Mr. Ward or any other party. And therefore, those individuals, if it becomes too burdensome of a process, may no longer want to participate. And the problem for that is, Your Honor, is as Mr. Zitzer says, the overall determination and goal is to discern the truth. If we don't have a stable of physicians that are willing to do these sorts of things for the department and the commission, then all of the parties are going to lose out.
I would be amazed that when someone is hired to do this, they don't determine what their time is worth and charge the commission accordingly.
Your Honor, they do charge for the written report. I can tell you that in my own experience in private practice, that frequently you find physicians who are willing to write reports, but when you say you may have to appear in court, that physician is going to say, wait a minute, I no longer want to participate because that's a headache that I don't want to have to endure.
That's fine, and I understand the physician's concern, and I have no interest in burdening them. But, you know, if you're in an adversarial system, which is what you're putting his report into, that, in my view, in fair play, requires a testing of the report. I mean, sometimes you put them in and the other side will say, fine, that looks fine to me, and we're done. And of course, it's very nice when everyone agrees and people can all go home happy. But when that doesn't happen, I don't see why the convenience of the physician should outweigh the fair play of someone who questions a report, particularly a report like this where they say the guy can work 8 hours a day and the next report says he can't work at all. He's totally disabled forevermore.
Well, I don't have the report necessarily right in front of me, but I take exception, I guess, to the assumption that the reports are somehow different from one another in the sense that in one sense he says, oh, he can work, and now here he's changed his mind. If that's what the inference is, I don't think that that's what the reports reflect.
I think that the conditions that he put in the initial report, and I think his opinion was, is that the man could work. Then there were more questions that were asked, I understand, for the second report, and it was based on that second report that it was determined that he was an, quote, odd lot, totally permanently disabled, right? Unless I have the facts screwed up.
It was based upon his opinion that the individual, Mr. Schaefer, was going to have periodic flare-ups of pain, and that is part of the condition with backs, is that each day may be different than the next, and therefore, the physician didn't change his opinion and say, oh, this fella can no longer work 8 hours a day. What he did, in fact, say was, is he's going to periodically have flare-ups to such an extent to where he would not be able to work at all during those flare-ups.
Counsel, as I understood the record, his report was he could work 8 hours a day, but probably 2 days a month, it would flare up so much that he wouldn't be able to work those 2 days a month. That was his report, and that was the subsequent communication. And from that information, then you have the vocational expert that testifies based on the doctor's report that is functionally he's an odd lot permanent total, because who's going to hire a 47-year-old who has a GED who can't work for 5 weeks out of, that was the report, 5 weeks out of the year. So it wasn't the medical doctor, it was the vocational expert based on the medical opinion, which included 2 days of flare-up a month. Am I right or wrong?
Oh, you are right, Your Honor, Justice Bradley. That is a situation where the commission has made the odd lot determination based upon a totality of the circumstances, not only including Dr. Ebert's opinion, but including Dr. Zadighi's opinion, including the opinion of Mr. Zitzer's expert, and including the opinion of the vocational experts. But I think that
I'm not questioning the commission's right to do what they did. My concern is really just, you know, when you get done with the proceeding, you want it to be fair. I know you work for that, okay? But you want it to feel fair to the other guy, too. And that seems to be the concern that's brought to us. Not that somehow the commission was biased. I don't think there's any inference of that. But what there is an inference is that I didn't have a fair shot to question this expert, and his opinion is the, quote, tiebreaker, or however you want to label it, so it's extremely important. And it's a feeling that fairness hasn't been accorded to both sides. I think that's what, at least that's what I'm hearing.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, or Justice Rogancic. I think that actually what we're hearing is we're hearing two things. Number one, what we're hearing from Mr. Zitzer and Aurora is that there's a statutory right, and I think that what Your Honor is focusing more on is that there's this due process right.
No, I'm talking about the statutory right.
Okay. Well, I think that if you're going to say that there's a statutory right to cross-examine, then somewhere in here you have to find this unequivocal guarantee of cross-examination, and I submit to you that it's not to be found.
Mr. Harlow,
is it precluded?
Go ahead.
Just that last question. Is it precluded? Is cross-examination statutorily precluded?
I don't know that it is prohibited, Your Honor.
Okay.
But it's certainly not mandated, as Mr. Zitzer has asserted, that it is shall be afforded a right to cross-examine. Yes, sir, Justice Crooks.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about a different statutory section, 102.17.1G, which is the one that talks about rebut. Now, I understand the position taken by Mr. Zitzer was that, we submitted a further report in response to Dr. Ebert, but I'm a little troubled after the word rebut about the language that talks about a further hearing. How do you address that particular issue?
Certainly, Your Honor. Number one, I think that 102.17.1G is the statute that this court should be focused on. It is the statute that provides for the process for the appointment. It is the statutory subsection that provides for the introduction of the report. And it is the statutory subsection that defines the rights of the parties. And there can be no disputing, Your Honor, that Mr. Zitzer, as well as Mr. Ward and their clients, had a right to rebut the opinions of Dr. Ebert on further hearing. The point is that that request was never made. Getting to your point on Mr. Zitzer's question, Justice Rogancic, his letter to the commission was not, please schedule a hearing so that I may have a hearing. His request to the Labor and Industry Review Commission was that they schedule a hearing or that it be remanded to the department for a continued hearing, quote, to elicit additional testimony from Dr. Ebert regarding his opinions, or to obtain a deposition of Dr. Ebert regarding these opinions. Otherwise, I request that the following additional questions be submitted to Dr. Ebert for his consideration. So this wasn't a request that the department or the LERC schedule a hearing so that further evidence can be taken. It was for the very pointed purpose of cross-examination of Dr. Ebert, and what the commission determined is that there is no statutory right to subpoena that physician for cross-examination purposes. And it's not to be found in the language. Shall have an opportunity to rebut such report on further hearing does not necessarily include the right to cross-examination. Nowhere in the plain language is it included, and I think that it is very important for this court to understand that where the legislature has intended that a party have a right to cross-examine a court-appointed physician, they have explicitly provided for it. They provided for it in the guardianship statutes under 54.42 sub 2, wherein they say that the proposed ward shall have a right to present and cross-examine witnesses, quote, including any physician or licensed psychologist who reports to the court concerning the proposed ward. That language, nor nothing similar, is found in 102.17.1G. And under 907.06, the legislature has provided that a court has authority to appoint experts, but where they do, quote, the witness shall be subject to cross-examination by each party, including a party calling the expert witness as a witness. Again, no similar provision is found in 102.17.1G.
Does DWD 22 sub 2 have anything to do with the right of cross-examination?
Justice Rogancic, I think that section DWD 80.22 sub 22 only modifies those reports and only applies to those reports that are admitted under 102.17.1D1. And the basis for that conclusion is if you look at the first sentence of 102.17.1D1, the final words say, subject to any rules and limitations the department prescribes. And that is the sentence that deals with reports that are submitted or presented by a party. This is a rule. 80.22 is a rule where the department has prescribed when reports of a party are to be admitted, and the department has determined that those reports of a party are to only be admitted where the individual consents to cross-examination or subject to cross-examination.
Okay, so if a party submits a report from a physician, then there has to be a right of cross-examination. But if the commission orders a report of a physician, there is no right to cross-examine that physician.
That's right, Your Honor. And that goes, again, to the Matthews balancing test, where the second factor in Matthews is the risk of an erroneous deprivation. And what we have when we have a party that has submitted it is we may have an appearance anyway where the party has curried favor with that expert either through the payment of fees or has somehow otherwise manipulated that report. But where we are dealing with a report under 102.17.1G, those concerns are not there. The statute provides, again, that it has to be a competent physician, that it has to be an impartial physician, and that it has to be a physician who is not regularly employed by an insurance carrier or a self-insured employer. So it alleviates some of the concerns that one might have regarding the bias of that particular expert.
Let me make clear, or see if I understand what you're saying. There is no requirement that cross-examination shall be allowed, but LIRC, in its discretion, is able to allow it. Isn't that correct, or am I wrong on that?
No, I think that you are right, Justice Bradley. The commission has the authority, and as trial courts do in general, to control the admission of evidence, and I think that the commission would certainly have at its disposal the opportunity and the right to say the report will not be considered unless the physician comes in to be cross-examined, or under these circumstances, this physician needs to be cross-examined. So I think that the LIRC does have the right to require a cross-examination if the report is to be admitted.
No, I'm not making myself clear. You just advanced the argument that under the language of the statutes, under D, sub D, that if a party is bringing in a report or a form with a report, that person shall, the practitioner, shall be subject to cross-examination. Now we're talking about the LIRC-directed examination. And your position is, as I heard it, that there is nothing in the statute that requires cross-examination. My question is, but if LIRC wants to allow cross-examination of the directed medical examination made by LIRC, nothing prohibits that, does it?
No, nothing prohibits that, Justice Bradley. And I would submit that the provisions under 102.17.1D1, which Aurora relies so heavily on, are not applicable to Dr. Ebert. Again, his opinion come in under 102.17.1G, not 1D1. And I think, and I note that my time has expired, but
sentence, please.
Thank you, Judge, or Justice Abrahamson. But I think that if you look at the two sentences in 102.17.1D1, one looks at the first sentence that provides that the contents of certified medical reports, and I'm paraphrasing or reading the pertinent parts, by physicians licensed in and practicing in this state, presented by a party for compensation, constitute prima facie evidence as to the matter contained in those reports,
yes,
subject to any rules and limitations the department prescribes. I'm telling you, in my opinion, 102.17.1D1 does not require a physician who is licensed in and practicing in this state to submit to cross-examination. I will agree with Justice Rogensack that DWD 80.22 requires that, but the statute itself doesn't. The second sentence is the statutory subsection that indicates that a physician shall consent to being subjected to cross-examination. But that applies to physicians wherever licensed and practicing who have examined or treated the claimant. I submit that that is If you look at the first section, it is in-state physicians. Their reports may be admitted by a party irrespective of their willingness to consent to cross-examination, except for 80.22, whereas the second sentence prescribes that those physicians who are licensed and practicing outside the state of Wisconsin, the only way that their reports can be admitted is if they have examined and or treated the claimant and if they subject themselves to cross-examination. So, and the purpose behind that is to get around what Mr. Zitzer so astutely recognized. Out-of-state physicians are beyond the subpoena power of the state of Wisconsin.
Counsel, I have one little follow-up question.
Justice
kind
Rogan
of going
said,
to what Justice Crooks had asked you earlier about 1G, about the phrase about further hearing. And you read part of the letter that was requested and objected to it because of what was asked for at that hearing. If he had just asked that a further hearing be set on this issue, would that have been sufficient?
I think that if he would have asked for a further hearing, then I think that the commission would have been obligated to set it on for further hearing. Provided
what he asked? He asked, but he said some of the things he wanted to do there. But he did ask for a hearing, didn't he, with what you read to us?
He asked for a hearing, but I disagree that he didn't ask for some of the things that he wanted to do there. He asked and informed the commission of the only thing that he wanted to do there, which was to cross-examine. And therefore, the commission determined cross-examination not appropriate in this circumstance and therefore denied the request.
If
had he asked for an opportunity to present further medical reports, have a further hearing to cross-examine
the
applicant?
Well, if he just asked, I would like to schedule a further hearing according to 10217-1G, period, end of letter, would he have gotten a hearing?
Well, Justice Rogensack, I like to think that he would have, and I think that he would be entitled to that.
And then could he have subpoenaed Dr. Ebert to that hearing and questioned him?
I don't believe that he could have.
Why not?
Again, I don't think that there's any provision for it, and the law is fairly clear, I think, that without some sort of provision for it, expert witnesses cannot be subpoenaed by an opposing party to render opinion. So I don't think that he would have been able to subpoena Dr. Ebert.
The law that you're referring to is a case law that relates generally to doctors, not to an administrative agency hearing.
Right.
And it was to protect doctors from becoming expert witnesses without anyone paying them.
Yeah, yes, sir. I believe that that is the case. But I think that the premise is the same.
Okay. One of the other things is it's my recollection that in the federal system, a federal judge can seek an expert to advise the judge. Does that ring a bell with you? Know anything about that, and that kind of expert is not subject to cross-examination?
In my brief, Your Honor, I referred to federal district court decisions that indicated that a psychologist that was retained and appointed by a court to render opinions regarding a criminal defendant in a sentencing hearing, the criminal defendant was not entitled to cross-examine that psychologist.
And sentencing is always a little special.
Right.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Ward, representing Mr. Schaefer.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abramson. I practice workers' compensation law for a living. I've been doing it for almost 30 years. So it's within that context that I look at this case, and most specifically, it's in that context that I looked at the dissent authored by Judge Fine from the Court of Appeals. And Judge Fine, acknowledging that the language of the statute didn't specifically allow for cross-examination of this particular type of expert, focuses on the language allowing either party the opportunity to rebut the expert's report and says allowing you to rebut the report but not cross-examine is like telling someone they can go swimming but they can't go near the water, which I thought was kind of humorous. And Judge Fine, I believe, like many of you, comes from a background in the civil or criminal courts. And in those courts, evidence is submitted by live testimony. In my business, Evidence is not submitted from experts by live testimony. Evidence in workers' compensation cases from medical experts is submitted through written report. I can tell you in my almost 30 years of practice, I have never subpoenaed an opposing medical expert to appear at a hearing strictly for the purpose of cross-examination, nor have I ever had it happen. The way we rebut evidence, and I'm not suggesting that what we do is what should be done. I'm just communicating to the court that the way we do business is that we rebut evidence by submitting an expert's report in rebuttal. The language of the statute accommodates that practice. The practice that we have of rebutting evidence with contrary written evidence from medical experts, because the system is set up not to provide for live medical testimony. It allows for it, but the system would come to a screeching halt if it was required in every single case. So we have statutes that allow for the submission of written medical reports, and we have provisions as to the circumstances under which that is allowable.
Counsel,
yes.
Reference was made to the letter sent by Aurora asking for cross-examination or deposition. Is there any allowance for depositions to be taken under Chapter 102?
I believe there is. I'm not too familiar with it, but I know that in my practice, on a rare occasion, judges have allowed for deposition testimony. I can't cite the statute, but it is allowed for at the discretion of the department. So maybe three times in my practice, we've taken depositions of someone that otherwise would not have been available. So in answer to your earlier question, whether or not the department or the LERC could have allowed for cross-examination through deposition, I believe they could have. I think that was within their discretion.
Is discovery deposition allowed in workers' comp?
No, there's no discovery. So if I anticipate that a witness is going to be called at the hearing, I'm not allowed to take a discovery deposition, or at least I don't think I am. I've never had it happen, and I've never had anyone ask for it. So maybe that's my answer. I don't believe discovery
is. What is the language in 102.17.1G mean in regard opportunity to rebut such report on further hearing? It doesn't say in writing. It says further hearing. What's a further hearing?
But what that means is that upon receipt of this report, either party can ask that a hearing be scheduled. And at that hearing, we would be allowed to present live testimony from our own expert. We would be able to submit a report from our own expert. We would be able to present testimony that would contradict the underpinnings of the opinion that we're attempting to rebut. For example, and this happens in cases all the time, I'll be trying to establish a level of disability of one of my clients. And the insurance carrier, they're not saying very much to me, so I know something's up. They come to the hearing and they have surveillance information that suggests that my client is physically capable of doing much more than his doctor is saying he can do. That's the type of rebuttal evidence that is contemplated by that statute, I believe. And it happens all the time. I recognize that, you know, we're having a problem with, well, what does it mean to have a hearing if you can't subpoena the doctor that you want to cross-examine? And the way you rebut it, I believe that that statute means you have the opportunity to rebut, but you don't have the opportunity to cross-examine. And the way that I mentioned is the way you'd rebut that.
Well, given the letter from Mr. Zitzer on behalf of Aurora, if I were sitting on the trial bench in Brown County, as I did for 19 years, I would say, gee, you know, under the statute, he's not entitled to cross-examine. But I'd sure read that letter as a request to rebut upon a further hearing. And if I were applying this section of the statute, I think I'd respond by saying, you've asked for a hearing. We're going to schedule it for a further hearing. but you can't cross-examine. Isn't that a reasonable response to what he did?
Well, it would be a reasonable response, but I'm suggesting that it was within the LIRC's discretion not to do so, and here's why I believe that to be true. Mr. Zitzer was very specific as to what it is he wanted to do. He said he either wanted to cross-examine the doctor appointed under 10217 sub 1G, or he asked that three questions be submitted to that doctor. And the LIRC reasonably said, you don't have the opportunity to cross-examine, and we'll take a look at what you would want to ask if you were given the opportunity to cross-examine. And in examining those questions, the LIRC reasonably reached the conclusion that the answers to those questions was not going to add any evidence that would be material to the dispute. In other words, they exercised their discretion to say, okay, what does he want to ask, and do we think that those questions merit forwarding on to this independent physician? And what goes into that, in part, is that the first remand results in a three-month delay in the resolution of this. In other words, it's not like a trial where we're just bringing people in and it's going to happen in a sequence. At the time that Mr. Zitzer asked for this relief, this case had been pending in front of the Labor and Industry Review Commission for 14 months.
Was this the third request for a remand?
It was a request for a third remand, okay. Correct. And my position is that another kind of curiosity in this case is that this particular statutory section, this remedy that the LIRC employed, again, I've been practicing this for 30 years. I've never had a case like this. They've never used this remedy before. My position is that this remedy was in response to Aurora's concerns. Aurora filed a petition for review. Their appeal specifically stated that they were concerned that the treating physician's restrictions impermissibly combined non-work-related restrictions related to a non-work-related hip disability, and work-related back problems. If you look at the remand order from the Labor and Industry Review Commission that appointed this physician, that was the specific question that the LIRC ordered this physician to address. This was a abnormal, extraordinary remedy in response to Aurora's concerns in the first place. And the second thing, Justice Crooks, in regard to your question, well, why don't you just set it on for hearing? This second report came out on March 3rd of 2009, and it was forwarded to the parties shortly thereafter, I believe by letter from the Workers' Comp Division on March 16th of 2009. At that point in time, the Workers' Compensation Division says, we have this report. We're going to close the record and send it back to the LIRC for a decision. Now, in the record is a letter from me to the Workers' Compensation Division asking that we be given an additional 30 days to submit additional vocational information. And in the letter, you can tell that I spoke with Mr. Zitzer, and I said, they're going to close the record. I don't want to close the record. I want to have another vocational evaluation done. Don't you? Yes. So I make a joint request for an additional 30 days so that we can supplement the record. My position is that if you wanted to somehow rebut this report, your obligation is to, at that point in time, say, well, I not only want to have additional vocational evaluations done, I want to rebut this report with medical evidence. Or I want to question this doctor. Because if we had done that in March, we're not another 6 weeks down the road on the very day the record's supposed to be closed, saying, oh, I'm looking at this record. I don't really like this record. What am I going to do about this? I better throw the Hail Mary and see if I can't complete this pass. Well, that's fine. I don't criticize Mr. Zitzer for doing that. If I was in his position, I probably would have done the same thing. But it's the court's obligation to monitor this and say, when is enough enough? And the court looked at the questions that Mr. Zitzer wanted to ask and made a determination that they didn't think that was going to add anything.
Are you saying that Mr. Zitzer asked on three different occasions to have the matter sent back?
No.
Okay, because I think that's what Justice Crooks took from your answer, that
no.
To his question?
I understood that there had been prior requests for a remand and that this was the third time a request had been made, but the first time on this particular sequence of events. Is that
That's right? That's
Were all three prior requests for a remand made by Mr. Zitzer?
No.
Okay, so some were made by you on behalf of your client.
How it went was this, is that we tried the case. We received a favorable decision at the trial court level. Mr. Zitzer filed an appeal. In his appeal, he complained that our medical evidence impermissibly combined two sets of restrictions, one for physical, one for non-physical. In response, the Labor and Industry Review Commission remanded this matter for the appointment of an independent physician. I received that report. I requested the opportunity to write to Dr. Ebert. That request was never granted. It wasn't responded to. But a couple of weeks later, the Labor and Industry Review Commission sent some questions to Dr. Ebert on the topic that I raised. So I'm perfectly comfortable saying it was probably in response to my request. It makes sense. And then the third request came from Mr. Zitzer again on May 1st of 2009.
Okay. All right.
So that's the sequence of how it went.
So one remand was by LIRC itself, one was maybe in response to a question you made, and the third was Mr. Zitzer's request.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I guess my position is, whether there's an opportunity to cross-examine or not, it's incumbent upon the person that wants that opportunity to at least ask for it in a timely manner. And it's within the LIRC's discretion to decide, is this request timely? And, you know, in looking at their decision, it wasn't really so much that they were focusing on whether the request was timely. They were looking at the substance of what Mr. Zitzer wanted to ask. And they decided, you know, we're looking at these questions, and these questions aren't going to really add much. For example, Mr. Zitzer said, I want to ask Dr. Ebert whether or not his opinion is given to a reasonable degree of medical probability. Well, that isn't an objection that is apparent anywhere else in the record. I can tell you that Dr. Kane's opinion, Dr. Siddiqui's opinion, the other opinions in the record are not specifically stated to be given to a reasonable degree of medical probability. And then the second two questions focus on whether or not my client would be able to avoid missing work twice a month if he worked part-time or worked some lower level of work. That is the question that wanted to be asked. Well, there wasn't anything in Dr. Ebert's report that suggested that the reason that my client would miss work two times a month was because of the level of exertion that he was going through. He said that the physical condition that he had, failed back syndrome, was such that it was likely to yield on a twice-a-month basis his unavailability for work. And that's an unpredictable thing. You had mentioned, Justice Rogensack, that you thought the doctor changed his mind.
I thought he added more to his opinion, and as you explain it, it was in response to your questions.
That's correct. He did add it, and it was my letter to LIRC requesting the opportunity to question that doctor pointed out that I thought it was a critical element to the case whether or not my client was going to experience unscheduled days when he wouldn't be available for work, because that was the restriction that rendered him unable to work. It wasn't that he couldn't lift enough. Everybody agreed that he could do sedentary work, but the restriction in the case that was critical was whether or not he would be available for work on a consistent basis. And that's what rendered him permanently and totally disabled, and that's why I asked for the opportunity to ask those questions of the doctor. Ultimately, I wasn't allowed to ask. The LIRC asked the questions, and that's how we ended up where we are.
Thank you.
And my red light is on.
Thank you, Mr. Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Ward.
Thank you.
Mr. Zitzer, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Counsel, before you get started, what I was going to ask you about before, and obviously you're free to order your rebuttal in any way you'd like, but I would like to hear from you your position in response to the harmless error argument. In other words, even if we do find that there was an error. Your opposing counsel argue in their briefs that it would have been harmless for the reasons alluded to by Mr. Ward in his most recent comments.
I would respond to that, Your Honor, by saying we don't know. We don't know what Dr. Ebert would say in response to those questions.
In other words, the odd lot finding having support in the record, doesn't that create a rebuttable presumption that you would have had the burden of trying to rebut?
That's right. We would have had to show a reasonably stable labor market for Mr. Schaefer. That's right.
Okay.
And my feeling on it, Your Honor, is if Dr. Ebert felt that given the level of work he said Mr. Schaefer could do, which was quite a bit higher than what this Dr. Sadecki had originally said he could do, what if, and that would cause him to possibly miss 2 days from work.
Yes.
I have a feeling that if I asked Dr. Ebert, is that an opinion you hold to a reasonable degree of medical probability that he's going to miss 2 days of work a month because of his back, and it's not going to be on a Saturday or a Sunday? I think he would say, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. That's speculative. And I think that if I asked Dr. Ebert, what about if he did part-time work? If he was working 20 hours a week instead of 8 hours a day, then do you think he would have to miss 2 days of work a week? He would probably say, I don't know, or maybe two days a month. And perhaps that would lead the vocational experts to say, no problem. He's not permanently and totally disabled. He's got a reasonably stable labor market. It might be a part-time labor market, but he's got a labor market, and he's not perm total.
Counsel, why didn't you request a further hearing? Why didn't you make a broader request for a further hearing to rebut? Request a further hearing to rebut. The request that you made was specifically to elicit additional testimony from Dr. Ebert regarding his opinion. I mean, your opposing counsel says, look, there's lots of ways to rebut. You can get a new report from your doctor and file it for that subsequent hearing. You can get your vocational expert either live or by report at that rebuttal hearing. Is the only reason you didn't request any hearing beyond a hearing for purposes of taking Dr. Ebert's testimony? Is that correct, or am I incorrect on that?
That's correct. At the time I made that request, there was already an opinion from a treating surgeon, from the treating surgeon in the record, that was helpful to my case. I already had an independent medical examination that was part of the record that was helpful to my case. I had the first set of restrictions from Dr. Ebert that were helpful to my case. The only problem that I had was that second report of Dr. Ebert and the voc reports, the vocational opinions that followed it. Your Honor, honestly, the only thing I wanted to do is ask Dr. Ebert some questions about his opinions, and I think I had the right to do that under the statute.
Statute being sub D or sub G?
Sub G.
G. D's out of the picture.
Well, I think sub D is helpful. It's helpful because it demonstrates the importance of the right of a party to cross-examine a physician whose opinion is made a part of the record, even an out-of-state physician. They have to consent to being cross-examined. So I think sub D demonstrates the significance of that right. But the right I have in this case is in sub G. Mr. Ward, in his response, said that Lurk said we didn't have the right to cross-examine Dr. Ebert in its decision. Lurk didn't say that in its decision. The only thing Lurk said in its decision was essentially that they didn't see any useful purpose in having us cross-examine Dr. Ebert. Lurk made that determination without knowing what Dr. Ebert was going to say. Just in closing, I would say that It's the fact that Dr. Ebert is an impartial witness, that his opinions and the right to explore those opinions are so important to my client in this case. I believe the statute gives us a meaningful right to rebut and explore those opinions, and that's why we're asking the court to reverse the commission's decision. That's all I have. Thank you.
To Mr. Zitzer, Mr. Harlow, Mr. Ward, for yet another argument in workers' comp. You would think after 100 years we would have settled it all out, but we haven't. 100 years, it still remains a very important aspect of Wisconsin progressive movement and protection of employers and employees. So thank you again for all of your arguments on this important case. And so ends the arguments in 10-18-208, Aurora Consolidated Healthcare versus Lurk. We are in recess till tomorrow morning when we will have oral arguments at 9:45. The court will meet in conference at, is it 3:10 now?
Yep.
3:30. I'm cutting that short.